Karin Zissis of ASCUA Online. On September 1st, Mexico witnessed the historic opening session of a new federal Congress. Historic because Morena, the party that swept both houses in the July vote, didn't even exist in the prior general elections of 2012. And that means President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who founded Morena, has a major legislative advantage when it comes to implementing his agenda. So what will his and Morena's priorities be? And if the opposition can't be a counterweight, then who can be? We get some answers in this episode, and we look at why, even though there's now gender parity in the new Congress, Mexico has a long way to go on that front.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
So I'm here with Oracid Barquero. He was chief of staff for Cristina Díaz, a senator for the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the PRI, for the state of Nuevo León in the last Congress. So it's really great to have a legislative insider with us today while we talk about the new Congress. So thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
When Andrés Manuel López Obrador won in July, it's fair to say that he won by a landslide. Now, I mean, not only did he get more than 50% of the vote, but he beat his top rival by about 30 points. The entire Congress was also renewed at that time, turned over. And we saw AMLO's party completely sweep there as well. And this is a party that didn't exist in the last general elections of 2012. And now it's looking like it'll be the biggest party in both the Chamber of Deputies, which is the lower house, and the Senate. So let's get down to the numbers. There are 500 seats in the chamber and 128 in the Senate. So how many seats does Morena have with its coalition? What kind of percentage of majority are we talking about?
Well, yes, as you said, it's very interesting. These last elections were historic in terms of the numbers in general, how much he won as president and how much they won in Congress and locally. Don't forget the local Congresses. Many of them were also renewed and they won. Morena, as a coalition, they'll be having 308.
So that's in the lower house, right?
In the lower house.
Now,
in the lower house. And in the Senate, Morena alone will be having 55. But as a coalition with the three parties, they'll be having 69 senators out of 128. So this is very, very relevant. In the lower house, your majority is 251. Mm-hmm. They're obviously above it. They are very close to what we call here qualified majority, which is a two-thirds majority for constitutional reforms. They're only a little bit less than 30 congressmen short of that majority. Mm-hmm. And in the Senate, they are 16 senators short of a constitutional reforms majority. Mm-hmm. So this is very, very relevant. We hadn't seen this since the 1980s.
What can AMLO... and what can his party do and what can they not do? You mentioned they can make constitutional reforms. Mm-hmm. What else can they do with this majority? And what are the chances that they could potentially create other alliances?
They can basically do almost anything with this majority because they also, as I mentioned, several local congresses were also renewed and Morena won majority in 18 out of the 32 local congresses. You need 17 for constitutional reform. So they're one above. Mm-hmm. So whatever they start in terms of constitutional reforms in the federal Congress, they will be able to get through in the local congresses. So that's a big thing. They will most likely be negotiating with other parties, of course, because if they want to get constitutional reforms through, they still need a few more. So they're going to have to negotiate with other parties, but it's not going to be difficult. The coalition that was formed by the right-wing PAN and the left-wing PRD and MC, mm-hmm. it will not survive. So most likely, several congressmen and senators from the PRD and from MC will be joining forces with López Obrador for specific things, not for everything, but they will be joining forces with him for specific things. So they'll have no problem getting things through.
Es un honor estar con Obrador. It's an honor to be with López Obrador. That's the sound of chanting at the swearing-in of the lower house last week. And already, coalitions are breaking up. One leader of the Green Party, which holds 16 seats in the lower house, said his party would break its alliance with the PRI and could back Morena instead. With this kind of legislative power, what will Morena prioritize first?
In the case of Morena, they've already established their priorities. One of them, as the president-elect has been saying, is the bill to create the Secretary of Public Security again. Remember that when Peña Nieto took office in 2012, one of the first things he did was eliminate this Secretary of Public Security and incorporate it into the Ministry of the Interior, so that all the security activities were held in that one ministry. Andrés Manuel López Obrador has made it very clear that he wants to separate them once more, as it used to be with the PAN governments. And he's already talked to President Peña Nieto to see whether President Peña will be presenting this bill during these last few months, or Morena will in Congress. That's still to be seen. We don't know how that's going to work out. But that's one of their first priorities, creating the Secretary of Public Security again. Also, everything that has to do with impeachment rules, they're going to be changing that so that you're able to try the president, even being in office. Another big issue for them is, during these months, introducing all the bills to make all the necessary changes to the executive's structure, to all the secretariats, because he's been saying that there will be a lot of changes in the organization of the federal government, and they need to make a lot of reforms in order to be able to carry out those changes. He's been reducing the number of undersecretaries for each secretariat. He's been creating a number of new positions, and he's also said that they will be reviewing the salary scheme, the benefit scheme of all federal workers, so they're going to have to make changes for that. And one of the main changes is that they want to reduce salaries, not just for the executive, but also for the judicial branch and for the legislative branch. So they're going to have to make legal changes for that as well. Particularly for the judicial branch, they're going to have to make a constitutional reform so that nobody can earn more than the president. Mm-hmm. So those are all their priorities from here to December. From here to November 30, so that on December 1st, when he takes office with this new structure.
Okay. And during the sexenio, the term of Peña Nieto, early on, there were a lot of reforms that were passed. Some of the reforms that he passed involved issues that have been controversial and that AMLO has talked about repealing. So, for example, areas like education or energy. Do you see those as being some issues that will be taken up in the legislature after he becomes president?
I think so. Yeah, most of them will be afterwards. He's been talking, of course, about the education reform. He's been moderating his speech on that part. He will not necessarily be repealing the whole reform. They are checking, and they just started a series of fora 1 week ago in Chiapas. They will be consulting with different communities. They started out with indigenous communities, and they'll be consulting with several communities related with education. And they'll be changing some of the aspects of the reform, keeping some of the aspects of the reform, and canceling some of the aspects of the reform.
Are there particularly sticky issues in the education reform that they want to get rid of or that they want to change?
They want to change the evaluation system of teachers. They also want to change the teacher's career system that was put into place. They haven't been very clear on which specific aspects they want to change, but we know that they want to change at least those two, which are two of the most controversial issues with the reform. Mm-hmm.
One thing I want to note is that the PRI went from being the largest party in both houses to, I think it's going to be the third biggest party
in the Senate.
And is it the fifth?
The fifth in the lower house.
In the lower house. Now, of course, you have these different coalitions. You talked a little bit about the other coalition with the National Action Party breaking up. This raises an important question. What's the counterweight going to be to AMLO and Morena? Will there be one?
Might at
be
the this better. Point, you can't really see counterweights. They have this huge majority in Congress, which would be one of the main counterweights to the executive. They have this huge majority in local Congresses as well. And they just won 5 governorships out of the 32. The PRI only holds 12, PAN holds 11, and I think PRD holds 1, and they have 5 now, which is a lot for a new party. I think what we need to build on right now are social counterweights. That's the only thing that can actually be built for this new government. Institutionally, this is a democracy and he won everything. So institutionally, he holds almost everything, except for the judicial, of course, which is not held by elections. So it has to be social counterweights. We have to build a system of checks and balances that includes society, that includes all the sectors of society, not just civil society organizations, but also the private sector. And the parties, particularly the PRI and the PAN, have to start, but they have to start now, not wait, a very, very deep reorganization process, almost refounding each of the two parties in order to be able to build a more institutional counterweight in the next few years. Because this will not be easy, this will not be fast. Neither the PRI nor the PAN seem to understand that they need to rebuild themselves, but they have to do it for the sake of the Democratic Party, of the Democratic system and the democratic governance of Mexico.
So Peña Nieto, for example, has said that the PRI should consider renaming itself, which would be a big move considering that the PRI controlled politics in the country for decades. Beyond changing the name, what more does it take?
Well, number one, I don't think Peña Nieto holds the moral high ground on this particular issue. I don't think he should be talking about what the PRI needs to do, since it was him and his team who actually affected the PRI with the type of government that they carried out. The discussion of whether to change the name of the PRI, I think, is secondary. I think before thinking about the name of the party, we need to think about how we're going to reconnect with society and how we're going to become a political option again for Mexicans. And the only way to do it, in my opinion, is, first of all, to publicly recognize all our mistakes these last few years, everything that the PRI did wrong, starting with the fact that we didn't do anything about the blatant corruption of some of our governors and the blatant corruption of the federal government. We as a party didn't do anything about it. And we didn't confront the president on several issues that we should have. And that has severely affected the credibility of the party with society. So that's number one, along with the process of expelling people from the party. All those people who damaged the party more, we need to expel them from the party. And that's the only way that society will be able to see that we really mean this reconfiguration of the party. And then, in order to think about how the party should rebuild itself, we need to go out to society and we need to ask them what they feel that a political party should be in the 21st century. I think the political parties in Mexico are stuck in the 1980s, not even the 90s. And we completely moved away from where society was going. We need to understand where society is right now and where society will be in the next 20, 30 years. And it's along with society, with the different sectors of society, that we need to rebuild our parties.
So those are some big ideas we talked about. Counterweight, we talked about completely revamping parties. We talked about being more in touch with society. What are some specific counterweights that you see? When you talk about working with society, what role do you see for the private sector, civil society? With the next 6 years of AMLO, what can those sectors be doing?
Well, first of all, the private sector needs to understand, particularly the big businesses, they need to understand that they're not in good standing with society either. They sort of have the same problem that we political parties have. They made very important mistakes during the election, confronting and even offending the candidate who is now president-elect. And they need to understand that in order to be able to become a counterweight, they need to legitimize themselves in front of society again. Some of them understand it. The private sector ended up significantly divided after the elections. Many of them did not agree with the strategy that that the private sector as a whole took during the elections. So they need to come up with ways of proving to society that they're interested not just in their businesses, but in the country, and that they are interested in improving the livelihood of their own employees, but Mexicans in general. And that's the only way that they'll be able to become a legitimized interlocutor with the government, with the new government. The new government is probably the most socially legitimized government that we've had in several years, in decades. So whomever plans on being a counterweight has to also be legitimized socially. In terms of civil society organizations, Mexico is one of the countries with the lowest social participation. The main challenge for CSOs and NGOs is to build a more informed, more participatory society in Mexico. That's the only way that society will understand that this is not just about what the government does for the country, but the country needs to be built by everyone. So there's a big challenge for civil society to become a much more important player in democracy and in the way things are done in Mexico.
One thing that also changed is some of the ways that the Congress will function. So there'll now be re-election, and this is the first incoming Congress, right, that's going to have re-election. So how does that work, and how do you think that's also going to change potentially political accountability in the country?
Re-election itself doesn't change anything. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a false debate that we had here when re-election was established in the Constitution, in the political reform of 2013-2014. What we need to do is have a much more professionalized legislative branch. This will be the first federal Congress that will be able to opt for re-election. I think that in order to really have a more professional legislative in Mexico, we need to focus on several aspects. One of them is a system that we just announced last week, 2 weeks ago, at the lower house. For the first time in Mexican history, there will be an evaluation system for congressmen. And it's been institutionalized in the lower house. A coordinating committee was created. Half of the committee is conformed by different authorities of the lower house, technical and political, and the other half is citizen participation. There are 5 seats for academic organizations, 5 seats for civil society organizations dealing with public policy, and 5 seats for private sector organizations. It was just announced. I had the honor of working with the president of the lower house on this project for the last few months. It's a very comprehensive system. It has quantitative and qualitative indicators, 140 indicators. Some of them are very basic, like the number of bills that are being introduced by each congressman, or their voting. But some of them are more complex. And we differentiate between the different types of congressmen that you can have. It's not the same to be president of the House to be president of a committee or being the coordinator of a particular political party in the House. So we take all of those issues into account. We're also evaluating how much Congress people are dealing with social sectors, whether or not they are listening to them when they are discussing issues, whether or not they take them into consideration when preparing their bills. And so it's a very comprehensive system. It's the first time we've had it. Not many countries in the region have it. Chile has a very good evaluation system, but the rest of them don't have it. We will be the second one in the region. And some other parliaments have them worldwide. The European Parliament has one. France has one. But this will be the first time. And we are hoping that these incoming legislators will respect that. That's the reason that the committee was conformed also by citizen participation, so that there is social pressure on the new Congress people for them to implement this evaluation system.
Given the evaluation system, will they come out almost getting something like grades? That will be something that will contribute as they are being assessed for re-election.
Yes. First of all, the system will be publicly available on the website, on the lower house's website, for everyone to see. And you will need to publish evaluations at the end of every legislative period. So one of the objectives with this system is for society to understand what a congressman does and what they have to do. And that way society will also understand what they can actually demand from a congressman, because not many people know what Congress does. And they're not very well informed. Nobody knows who their congressman is. Nobody knows what their district is. So in order for re-election to actually work, you need this type of systems, because people need to know what Congress does to be able to understand whether or not they have to vote again for someone, whether or not to allow their congressman to be re-elected. And this is one of the ways that you can do that.
And one quick question, then I want to close, because I know that you were short on time. This is for the lower house that re-election is coming in. And the Senate re-election,
yes.
Is that in the next midterms, or when does Senate re-election
start? No, the senators have six-year periods.
Uh-huh.
So the re-election will be with the next presidential election.
Will be the next presidential election, of course. Okay, great. Just to wrap things up, I want to switch to a slightly different topic. There was much celebration after the election because the Congress, both houses of Congress, achieved close to equal gender parity between men and women. And then in recent days, there was sort of a bittersweet because all of the parties, the heads of the parties in Congress, they're all going to be run by men. There were no women's faces showing up, right? So equal in terms of seats, but not necessarily in terms of overseeing everything. So how do you see this? I know you were involved while you were working with Senator Diaz in terms of gender legislation and things like that. What is your view on this?
Well, I think it's very important. We will become, we just became, probably the third or fourth country with the best parity numbers in Congress, in both houses of Congress. We were already number one among OECD countries during the 2015 elections in the lower house. But this is the first year that it applies to the Senate also. So we have achieved in the Senate 49% of women, 51% men. Mm-hmm. And in the lower house, we are at 48% women and 52% men. So this is historic. This brings us up to the third or second country in the world. Surprisingly, Bolivia is still above us. Mm-hmm. But this is a very good thing. This is the result of a constitutional mandate for political parties to award 50% of their legislative candidacies to women. And this was done in the 2013-2014 political reform. I think it's very important. It's a huge step forward, but we still have very important steps to take. Mexico lags the region in many other issues, particularly the economic participation of women. But also in the executive branch, this is all legislative branch. In the executive branch, we are decades behind. We, during the outgoing administration of Peña Nieto, out of the 18 ministries, there are only two women. In gubernatorial positions, we only have one woman out of 32. And in all of Mexico's history, we've only had seven women governors. And at the municipal level, we're probably at around 30% of women mayors. So we still have a long way to go on that side. But in terms of economic inclusion, thinking about the top positions, we are the last place in Latin America in terms of women on boards. We only have 6.3% of women on boards. The average for Latin America is 14%. Colombia is at 16%. That's one of the things we tried to do, implement a system, not necessarily quotas, but a temporary system of minimum percentages. We were setting it at 20% for publicly traded companies. Also, we only have 43% of women participating in the labor force, when the OECD average is 67. And we also have only 1% or a little bit less than 1% of women CEO of major companies. So we're not doing good. The legislative branch is a different issue. That's because it's very easy to impose quotas on that branch, but now we need to work on the executive branch and on the economic participation of women. The incoming government will apparently have many more women out of the 18 ministries, potentially 8 will be women, and some other important positions are also being appointed by the president-elect for women. There's hope there, but we need to work a lot. And the first step for this is for the private sector to open up their minds, because that's been a huge obstacle for including more women in the economic labor markets.
Great. So a lot more work to be done.
A lot more.
Thank you so much for talking with me today, Odrasir.
No, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissas. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Gonzalez. You can get more information about Mexico's July election and incoming government at as-coa.org/mxelex. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. Check out upcoming concerts at musicoftheamericas.org. If you like this podcast, leave us a review and subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or Stitcher.